on the Bikura, on the Shrike, and on myself. Eventually, I ceased speculating and closed my eyes to pray. When I emerged from the cave, the cruciform cool against my chest under the robe, the 70 were obviously ready to begin the 3-kilometer climb up the staircase. I looked up to see a pale slash of morning sky between the walls of the cleft. "No!" I shouted, my voice almost lost against the roar of the river. "I need rest, rest!" I sank to my knees on the sand, but half a dozen of the Bikura approached, pulled me gently to my feet, and moved me toward the staircase. I tried. The Lord knows that I tried. But 2 or 3 hours into the climb, I felt my legs give way and I collapsed, sliding across the rock, unable to stop my 600-meter fall to the rocks and river. I remember grasping at the cruciform under the thick robe, and then half a dozen hands stopped my slide, lifted me, carried me. Then I remember no more. Until this morning, I awoke to a sunrise pouring light through the opening of my hut. I wore only the robe, and a touch assured me that the cruciform was still hanging from its fibrous thong. As I watched the sun lift over the forest, I realized that I had lost a day, that somehow I had slept through not only my ascent up that endless staircase. How could these little people carry me 2.5 vertical kilometers? But through the next day and night as well. I looked around my hut. My comm log and other recording devices were gone. Only my med scanner, and a few packets of anthropological software made useless by the destruction of my other equipment, remained. I shook my head and went up to the stream to wash. The Bikura appeared to be sleeping. Now that I had participated in their ritual and become of the cruciform, they seemed to have lost interest in me. As I stripped to bathe, I decided to take no interest in them. I decided that I would leave as soon as I was strong enough. I would find a way around the flame forests if necessary. I could descend the staircase and follow the Khans if I had to. I knew more than ever that word of these miraculous artifacts had to be brought to the outside world. I pulled off the heavy robe, stood pale and shivering in the morning light, and went to lift the small cruciform from my chest. It did not come off. It lay there, as if it were part of my flesh. I pulled, scraped, and tore at the thong until it snapped and fell away. I clawed at the cross-shaped lump on my chest. It did not come off. It was as if my flesh had sealed itself around the edges of the cruciform. Except for the scratches from my fingernails, there was no pain or physical sensation in the cruciform or surrounding flesh, only sheer terror in my soul at the thought of this thing attached to me. After the first rush of panic subsided, I sat a minute and then hastily pulled on my robe and ran back to the village. My knife was gone, my mazer, scissors, razor, everything that might have helped me peel back the growth on my chest. My nails left bloody tracks across the red welt and my chest. Then I remembered the med scanner. I passed the transceiver over my chest, read the disc key display, shook my head in disbelief, and then ran an entire body scan. After a while, I keyed in a request for hard copies of the scan results and sat motionless for a very long time. I sit here now holding the image wafers. The cruciform is quite visible on both the sonic and K-cross images, as are the internal fibers that spread like thin tentacles, like roots, throughout my body. Excess ganglia radiate from a thick nucleus above my sternum to filaments everywhere. A nightmare of nematodes. As well as I can tell with my simple field scanner, the nematodes terminate in the amygdala and other basal ganglia in each cerebral hemisphere. My temperature, metabolism, and lymphocyte level are normal. There has been no invasion of foreign tissue. According to the scanner, The nematotic filaments are the result of extensive but simple metastasis. According to the scanner, the cruciform itself is composed of familiar tissue. The DNA is mine. I am of the cruciform. Day 116. Each day I pace the confines of my cage. The flame forests to the south and east, the forested ravines to the northeast, and the cleft to the north and west. The 70 will not let me descend into the cleft beyond the basilica. The cruciform will not let me get more than 10 kilometers from the cleft. At first I could not believe this. I had resolved to enter the flame forests, trusting to luck and to God's help to see me through. But I had gone no more than 2 kilometers into the fringes of the forest when pain struck me in the chest and arms and head. I was sure that I was having a massive heart attack. But as soon as I turned back toward the cleft, the symptoms ceased. I experimented for some time, and the results were invariably the same. Whenever I ventured deeper into the flame forest, away from the cleft, the pain would return and increase in severity until I turned back. I begin to understand other things. Yesterday, I happened across the wreckage of the original seed ship shuttle as I explored to the north. Only a rusted, vine-enmeshed wreck of metal remains among the rocks at the edge of the flame forest near the ravine. But crouching among the exposed alloy ribs of the ancient craft, I could imagine the rejoicing of the 70 survivors, their short voyage to the cleft, their eventual discovery of the basilica, and what? Conjectures beyond that point are useless, but suspicions remain. Tomorrow I will attempt another physical exam of one of the Bikura. Perhaps now that I am of the cruciform, they will allow it. Each day I do a med scan of myself. The nematodes remain, perhaps thicker, perhaps not. I am convinced that they are purely parasitic, although my body has shown no signs of this. I peer at my face in the pool near the waterfall and see only the same long, aging countenance that I have learned to dislike in recent years. This morning, while gazing at my image in the water, I opened my mouth wide, half thinking that I would see gray filaments and nematode clusters growing from the roof of my mouth and the back of my throat. There was nothing. Day 117. The Bikura are sexless. Not celibate or hermaphroditic or undeveloped. Sexless. They are as devoid of external or internal genitalia as a child's flow foam doll. There is no evidence that the penis or testes or comparable female organs have atrophied or been surgically altered. There is no sign that they ever existed. Urine is conducted through a primitive urethra, terminating in a small chamber contiguous with the anus, a sort of crude cloaca. Beta allowed the examination. The med scanner confirmed what my eyes would not believe. Del and Theta also agreed to be scanned. I have absolutely no doubt that the rest of the 70 are equally sexless. There is no sign that they have been altered. I would suggest that they had all been born that way, but from what kind of parents? And how do these sexless lumps of human clay plan to reproduce? It must be tied in with the cruciform in some way. When I was finished with their med scans, I stripped and studied myself. The cruciform rises from my chest like pink scar tissue. But I am still a man. For how long? Day 133. Alpha is dead. I was with him 3 mornings ago when he fell. We were about 3 kilometers east, hunting for chalma tubers in the large boulders near the edge of the cleft. It had been raining most of the past 2 days, and the rocks were quite slippery. I looked up from my own scrambling, just in time to see Alpha lose his footing and go sliding down a broad slab of stone over the edge. He did not shout. The only sound was the rasp of his robe against the rock, followed several seconds later by the sickening dropped melon sound of his body striking a ledge 80 meters below. It took me an hour to find a route down to him. Even before I began the treacherous descent, I knew it was too late to help. But it was my duty. Alpha's body was half wedged between two large rocks. He must have died instantly. His arms and legs were splintered, and the right side of his skull had been crushed. Blood and brain tissue clung to the wet rock like the refuse of a sad picnic. I wept as I stood over the little body. I do not know why I wept, but I did. And as I wept, I administered extreme unction and prayed that God would accept the soul of this poor, sexless little person. Later I wrapped the body in vines, laboriously climbed the 80 meters of cliff, and, pausing frequently to pant with exhaustion, pulled the broken corpse up to me. There was little interest as I carried the body of Alpha into the Bikura village. Eventually, Beta and half a dozen others wandered over to stare down indifferently at the corpse. No one asked me how he had died. After a few minutes, the small crowd dispersed. Later, I carried Alpha's body to the promontory where I had buried Tuck so many weeks earlier. I was digging the shallow grave with a flat stone when Gamma appeared. The Bikura's eyes widened, and for a brief second I thought I saw emotion cross those bland features. "What are you doing?" asked Gamma. "Burying him." I was too tired to say more. I leaned against a thick chalma root and rested. "No." It was a command. "He is of the cruciform." I stared as Gamma turned and walked quickly back to the village. When the Bikura was gone, I pulled off the crude fiber tarp I had draped over the corpse. Alpha was, without any doubt, truly dead. It no longer mattered to him or the universe whether he was of a cruciform or not. The fall had stripped him of most of his clothes and all of his dignity. The right side of his skull had been cracked and emptied like a breakfast egg. One eye stared sightlessly toward Hyperion sky through a thickening film, while the other looked out lazily from under a drooping lid. His ribcage had been splintered so thoroughly that shards of bone protruded from his flesh. Both arms were broken, and his left leg had been twisted almost off. I had used the med scanner to perform a perfunctory autopsy, and it had revealed massive internal injuries. Even the poor devil's heart had been pulped by the force of the fall. I reached out and touched the cold flesh. Rigor mortis was setting in. My fingers brushed across the cross-shaped welt on his chest, and I quickly pulled my hand away. The cruciform was warm. "Stand away." I looked up to see Beta and the rest of the Bikura standing there. I had no doubt that they would murder me in a second if I did not move away from the corpse. As I did so, an idiotically frightened part of my mind noted that the 70 were now the 79. It seemed funny at the time. The Bikura lifted the body and moved back toward the village. Beta looked at the sky, looked at me, and said, "It is almost time. You will come." We went down into the cleft. The body was carefully tied into a basket of vines and lowered with us. The sun was not yet illuminating the interior of the basilica when they set Alpha's corpse on the broad altar and removed his remaining rags. I do not know what I expected next, some ritual act of cannibalism, perhaps. Nothing would have surprised me. Instead, one of the Bikura raised his arms, just as the first shafts of colored light entered the basilica and intoned, "You will follow the cross all of your days." The 70 knelt and repeated the sentence. I remained standing. I did not speak. You will be of the cruciform all of your days, said the little Bikura. And the basilica echoed to the chorus of voices repeating the phrase. Light, the color and texture of clotting blood, threw a huge shadow of the cross on the far wall. You will be of the cruciform now and forever and ever, came the chant, as the winds rose outside and the organ pipes of the canyon wailed with the voice of a tortured child. When the Bikura stopped chanting, I did not whisper, Amen. I stood there while the others turned and left with the sudden, total indifference of spoiled children who have lost interest in their game. There is no reason to stay, said Beta, when the others had gone. I want to, I said, expecting a command to leave. Beta turned without so much as a shrug and left me there. The light dimmed. I went outside to watch the sun set, and when I returned, it had begun. Once, years ago in school, I saw a time-lapse hollow showing the decomposition of a kangaroo mouse. A week's slow work of nature's recycling had been accelerated to 30 seconds of horror. There was the sudden, almost comic bloating of the little corpse, then the stretching of flesh into lesions, followed by the sudden appearance of maggots in the mouth, eyes, and open sores, and finally, the sudden and incredible corkscrew cleaning of meat from the bones. There is no other phrase that fits the image. As the pack of maggots spiraled right to left, head to tail, in a time-lapsed helix of carrion consumption that left behind nothing but bones and gristle and hide. Now it was a man's body I watched. I stopped and stared, the last of the light fading quickly. There was no sound in the echoing silence of the basilica, except for the pounding of my pulse in my own ears. I stared as Alpha's corpse first twitched and then visibly vibrated, almost levitating off the altar in the spastic violence of sudden decomposition. For a few seconds, the cruciform seemed to increase in size and deepen in color, glowing as red as raw meat, and I imagined then that I caught a glimpse of the network of filaments and nematodes holding the disintegrating body together like metal fibers in a sculptor's melting model. The flesh flowed. I stayed in the basilica that night. The area around the altar remained lit by the glow of the cruciform on Alpha's chest. When the corpse moved, the light would cast strange shadows on the walls. I did not leave the basilica until Alpha left on the third day, but most of the visible changes had taken place by the end of that first night. The body of the Bikura I had named Alpha was broken down and rebuilt as I watched. The corpse that was left was not quite Alpha, and not quite not Alpha, but it was intact. The face was a flow foam doll's face, smooth and unlined, features stamped in a slight smile. At sunrise of the third day, I saw the corpse's chest begin to rise and fall, and I heard the first intake of breath, a rasp like water being poured into a leather pouch. Shortly before noon, I left the basilica to climb the vines. I followed Alpha. He has not spoken, will not reply. His eyes have a fixed, unfocused look, and occasionally he pauses as if he hears distant voices calling. No one paid attention to us when we returned to the village. Alpha went to a hut and sits there now. I sit in mine. A minute ago, I opened my robe and ran my fingers across the welt of the cruciform. It lies benignly under the flesh of my chest, waiting. Day 140. I am recovering from my wounds and the loss of blood. It cannot be cut out with a sharpened stone. It does not like pain. I lost consciousness long before the pain or loss of blood demanded it. Each time I awoke and resumed cutting, I would be made to pass out. It does not like pain. Day 158. Alpha speaks some now. He seems duller, slower, and only vaguely aware of me or anyone else, but he eats and moves. He appears to recognize me to some extent. The med scanner shows the heart and internal organs of a young man, perhaps of a boy of 16. I must wait about another Hyperion month and 10 days, about 50 days in all, until the flame forests become quiet enough for me to try to walk out, pain or no pain. We will see who can stand the most pain. Day 173. Another death. The one called Will, the one with the broken finger, had been missing for a week. Yesterday, the Bikoro went several kilometers northeast, as if following a beacon, and found the remains near the great ravine. Evidently, a branch had snapped while he was climbing to grasp some chalma fronds. Death must have been instantaneous when he broke his neck. But it is where he fell that is important. The body, if one could call it that, was lying between two great mud cones marking the burrows of the large red insects that Tuck called fire mantises. Carpet beetles might have been a more apt phrase. In the past few days, the insects had stripped the corpse clean to the bone. Little was left to be found except the skeleton, some random shreds of tissue and tendon, and the cruciform, still attached to the rib cage like some splendid cross packed in the sarcophagus of a long-dead pope. It is terrible, but I cannot help but feel some small sense of triumph beneath the sadness. There is no way that the cruciform can regenerate something out of these bare bones. Even the terrible illogic of this accursed parasite must respect the imperative of the law of conservation of mass. The Bikoro I called Will has died the true death. The 70 truly are the 79 from this time on. Day 174. I am a fool. Today I inquired about Will, about his dying the true death. I was curious at the lack of reaction from the Bikoro. They had retrieved the cruciform, but left the skeleton lying where they had found it. There was no attempt to carry the remains to the basilica. During the night, I had become concerned that I would be made to fill the role of the missing member of the 70. "It is very sad," I said, "that one of you has died the true death. What is to become of the 70? Beta stared at me. "He cannot die the true death," said the bald little androgyny. "He is of the cruciform." Somewhat later, while continuing my med scans of the tribe, I discovered the truth. The one I have tagged as Theta looks the same and acts the same, but now carries two cruciforms embedded in his flesh. I have no doubt that this is one Bikoro who will tend toward corpulence in coming years, swelling and ripening like some obscene E. coli cell in a petri dish. When he, she, it dies, two will leave the tomb, and the 70 will be complete once more. I believe I am going mad. Day 195. Weeks of studying the damn parasite, and still no clue as to how it functions. Worse, I no longer care. What I care about now is more important. Why has God allowed this obscenity? Why have the Bikoro been punished this way? Why was I chosen to suffer their fate? I ask these questions in nightly prayers, but I hear no answers. Only the blood song of the wind from the cleft. Day 214. The last 10 pages should have covered all of my field notes and technical conjectures. This will be my last entry before attempting the quiescent flame forest in the morning. There is no doubt that I've discovered the ultimate in stagnant human societies. The Bikura have realized the human dream of immortality, and have paid for it with their humanity and their immortal souls. Edward, I have spent so many hours wrestling with my faith, my lack of faith. But now, in this fearful corner of an all-but-forgotten world, riddled as I am with this loathsome parasite, I have somehow rediscovered a strength of belief the likes of which I have not known since you and I were boys. I now understand the need for faith. Pure, blind, fly-in-the-face-of-reason faith. As a small life preserver, in the wild and endless sea of a universe ruled by unfeeling laws and totally indifferent to the small, reasoning beings that inhabit it. Day after day I have tried to leave the cleft area, and day after day I have suffered pain so terrible that it has become a tangible part of my world, like the too small sun or the green and lapis sky. Pain has become my ally, my guardian angel, my remaining link with humanity. The cruciform does not like pain. Nor do I, but like the cruciform, I am willing to use it to serve my purposes. And I will do so consciously, not instinctively, like the mindless mass of alien tissue embedded in me. This thing only seeks a mindless avoidance of death by any means. I do not wish to die, but I welcome pain and death rather than an eternity of mindless life. Life is sacred. I still hold to that as a core element of the Church's thought and teachings these past 2,800 years, when life has been so cheap. But even more sacred is the soul. I realize now that what I was trying to do with the Armagas data was offer the Church not a rebirth, but only a transition to a false life, such as these poor, walking corpses inhabit. If the Church is meant to die, it must do so, but do so gloriously, in the full knowledge of its rebirth in Christ. It must go into the darkness, not willingly, but well, bravely and firm of faith, like the millions who have gone before us, keeping faith with all those generations facing death in the isolated silence of death camps and nuclear fireballs and cancer wards and pogroms, going into the darkness, if not hopefully, then prayerfully that there is some reason for it all, something worth the price of all that pain, all those sacrifices. All those before us have gone into the darkness without assurance of logic or fact or persuasive theory, with only a slender thread of hope or the all-too-shakable conviction of faith. And if they have been able to sustain that slim hope in the face of darkness, then so must I, and so must the Church. I no longer believe that any surgery or treatment can cure me of this thing that infests me. But if someone can separate it, and study it, and destroy it, even at the cost of my death, I will be well satisfied. The flame forests are as quiet as they will ever be. To bed now. I leave before dawn. Day 215. There is no way out. 14 kilometers into the forest. Stray fires and bursts of current, but penetrable. 3 weeks of walking would have got me through. The cruciform will not let me go. The pain was like a heart attack that would not stop. Still I staggered forward, stumbling and crawling through the ash. Eventually I lost consciousness. When I came to, I was crawling toward the cleft. I would turn away, walk a kilometer, crawl 50 meters, then lose consciousness again and awake back where I had started. All day this insane battle for my body went on. Before sunset, the Bikura entered the forest, found me 5 kilometers from the cleft, and carried me back. Dear Jesus, why have you let this be? There is no hope now, unless someone comes looking for me. Day 223. Again the attempt. Again the pain. Again the failure. Day 257. I am 68 standard years old today. Work goes on with the chapel I am building near the cleft. Attempted to descend to the river yesterday, but was turned back by Beta and 4 others. Day 280. 1 local year on Hyperion. 1 year in purgatory. Or is it hell? Day 311. Working on quarrying stones on the ledges below the shelf where the chapel is going up, and I made the discovery today. The arrestor rods. The Bikura must have thrown them over the edge when they murdered Tuck that night 223 days ago. These rods would allow me to penetrate the flame forest at any time if the cruciform would allow it. But it will not. If only they had not destroyed my med kits with the painkillers. But still, sitting here holding the rods today, I have an idea. My crude experiments with the med scanner have continued. 2 weeks ago, when Theta broke his leg in 3 places, I observed the reaction of the cruciform. The parasite did its best to block the pain. Theta was unconscious much of the time, and his body was producing incredible quantities of endorphins. But the break was a very painful one, and after 4 days the Bikura slashed Theta's throat and took his body to the basilica. It was easier for the cruciform to resurrect his corpse than to tolerate such pain over a long period. But before his murder, my scanner showed an appreciable retreat of the cruciform nematodes from some parts of the central nervous system. I do not know if it would be possible to inflict on oneself, or to tolerate, levels of non-lethal pain sufficient to drive the cruciform out completely. But I am sure of one thing. The Bikura would not allow it. Today, I sit on the ledge below the half-finished chapel, and I consider possibilities. Day 438. The chapel is finished. It is my life's work. Tonight, when the Bikura went down into the cleft for their daily parody of worship, I said Mass at the altar of the newly erected chapel. I had baked the bread from chalma flour, and I am sure that it must have tasted of that bland yellow leaf. But to me the taste was exactly like that of the first host I had partaken of during my first Holy Communion, in Villefranche-sur-Saône, some 60 standard years earlier. In the morning, I will do what I have planned. Everything is in readiness. My journals and the med-scan wafers will be in the pouch of woven bestos fibers. That is the best I can do. The consecrated wine was only water, but in the dim light of sunset it looked blood-red and tasted of communion wine. The trick will be to penetrate deep enough into the flame forest. I will have to trust that there is enough incipient activity in and from the Tesla trees, even during the quiet periods. Goodbye, Edward. I doubt if you are still alive. And should you be, I see no way that we could ever be reunited. Separated as we are, not only by years of distance, but by a much wider gulf in the form of a cross. My hope of seeing you again shall not be placed on this life, but on the one to come. Strange to hear me speak like this again, is it not? I must tell you, Edward, that after all these decades of uncertainty, and with great fear of what lies ahead, my heart and soul are nonetheless at peace. Oh, my God! I am heartily sorry for having offended thee. and I detest all my sins because of the loss of heaven and the pains of hell, but most of all because I have offended thee, my God, who art all good and deserving of all my love. I firmly resolve, with the help of thy grace, to confess my sins, to do penance, and to amend my life. Amen. 2400 hours. The sunset comes through the open chapel window and bathes the altar, the crudely carved chalice, and me in light. The wind from the cleft rises in the last such chorus that, with luck and God's mercy, I will ever hear.
That is the final entry, said Lenar Hoyt.
When the priest quit reading, the six pilgrims at the table raised their faces toward him, as if they were awakening from a common dream. The consul glanced upward and saw that Hyperion was much closer now, filling a third of the sky, banishing the stars with its cold radiance.
"I arrived some 10 weeks after I had last seen Father Duret," continued Father Hoyt. His voice was a hoarse rasp. "More than 8 years had passed on Hyperion. 7 years since the last entry in Father Duret's journal."
The priest was visibly in pain now. His face paled to a sick luminescence and filmed with perspiration.
"Within a month I found my way to Paracebo Plantation, upriver from Port Romance," he continued, forcing some strength into his voice. "My assumption was that the fiberplastic growers might tell me the truth, even if they would have nothing to do with the consulate or home rule authorities. I was right. The administrator at Paracebo, a man named Orlandi, remembered Father Duret, as did Orlandi's new wife, the woman named Sempha, whom Father Duret mentioned in his journals. The plantation manager had tried to mount several rescue operations onto the plateau, but an unprecedented series of active seasons in the flame forests had made them abandon their attempts. After several years, they had given up hope that Duret or their man Tuck could still be alive. Nonetheless, Orlandi recruited 2 expert bush pilots to fly a rescue expedition up the cleft in 2 plantation skimmers. We stayed in the cleft itself for as long as we could, trusting to terrain avoidance instruments and luck to get us to Bikura country. Even with bypassing most of the flame forest that way, we lost one of the skimmers and 4 people to Tesla activity.
Father Hoyt paused and swayed slightly. Gripping the edge of the table to steady himself, he cleared his throat and said,
"There's little else to tell. We located the Bikura village. There were 70 of them, each as stupid and uncommunicative as Duret's notes had suggested. I managed to ascertain from them that Father Duret had died while trying to penetrate the flame forest. The Bestos pouch had survived, and in it we found his journals and medical data."
Hoyt looked at the others a second time and then glanced down.
"We persuaded them to show us where Father Duret had died. They had not buried him. His remains were badly burned and decomposed, but complete enough to show us that the intensity of the Tesla charges had destroyed the cruciform, as well as his body. Father Duret had died the true death. We returned the remains to the Paracebo plantation, where he was buried following a full funeral mass."
Hoyt took a deep breath.
"Over my strong objections, M. Orlandi destroyed the Bikura village and a section of the cleft wall with shaped nuclear charges he had brought from the plantation. I do not believe that any of the Bikura could have survived. As far as we could tell, the entrance to the labyrinth and the so-called basilica also must have been destroyed in the landslide. I had sustained several injuries during the expedition, and thus had to remain at the plantation for several months before returning to the northern continent and booking passage to Pachim. No one knows of these journals or their contents, except M. Orlandi, Monsignor Edouard, and whichever of his superiors Monsignor Edouard chose to tell. As far as I know, the church has issued no declaration relating to the journals of Father Paul Doré.
Father Hoyt had been standing, and now he sat. Sweat dripped from his chin, and his face was blue-white in the reflected light of Hyperion.
"Is that all?"
asked Martin Silenus.
"Yes," managed Father Hoyt.
"Gentlemen and lady,"
said Hetmastine,
"it is late. I suggest that you gather your luggage and rendezvous at our friend the consul's ship on Sphere 11 in 30 minutes or sooner. I will be using one of the tree's dropships to join you later."
Most of the group was assembled in less than 15 minutes. The Templars had rigged a gangway from a work pier on the interior of the sphere to the ship's top-tier balcony, and the consul led the way into the lounge as crew clones stowed luggage and departed.
"A fascinating old instrument,"
said Colonel Cassad, as he ran one hand across the top of the Steinway.
"Harpsichord?"
"Piano,"
said the consul.
"Pre-Hegira. Are we all here?"
"Everyone except Hoyt,"
said Braun Lamia, as she took a seat in the projection pit. Hetmastine entered.
"The Hegemony warship has granted permission for you to descend to Keats Spaceport,"
said the captain. He glanced around.
"I will send a crew member to see if M. Hoyt needs assistance."
"No,"
said the consul. He modulated his voice.
"I'd like to get him. Can you tell me the way to his quarters?"
The tree ship captain looked at the consul for a long second, and then reached into the folds of his robe.
"Bon voyage,"
he said, handing over a wafer.
"I will see you on the planet, sometime before our midnight departure time from the Shrike's temple in Keats."
The consul bowed.
"It was a pleasure traveling within the protective branches of the tree, Hetmastine,"
he said formally. Turning to the others, he gestured.
"Please make yourselves comfortable in the lounge or the library on the deck below this. The ship will see to your needs and answer any questions you might have. We will depart as soon as Father Hoyt and I return."
The priest's environment pod was halfway up the tree ship, far out on a secondary branch. As the consul expected, the comlog direction wafer Hetmastine had given him also served as a pomlock override. After useless minutes tapping the announcer chime and pounding on the access portal, the consul triggered the override and stepped into the pod. Father Hoyt was on his knees, writhing in the center of the grass carpet. Bedclothes, gear, garments, and the contents of a standard medkit were strewn on the floor around him. He had torn off his tunic and collar and sweated through his shirt, so that it now hung in damp folds, ripped and tattered, where he had clawed through the fabric. Hyperion light seeped through the pod wall, making the bizarre tableau appear to be staged underwater. Or, thought the consul, in a cathedral. Lenar Hoyt's face contorted in agony as his hands raked at his chest. Muscles on his exposed forearms writhed like living creatures moving beneath his pale tarp of a skin.
"The injector malfunctioned," gasped Hoyt. "Please."
The consul nodded, commanded the door to close, and knelt next to the priest. He removed the useless injector from Hoyt's clenched fist and ejected the Surette ampule. Ultramorphine. The consul nodded again and took out an injector from the medkit he had brought from his ship. It took less than 5 seconds to load the ultramorph.
"Please," begged Hoyt.
His whole body spasmed. The consul could almost see the waves of pain passing through the man.
"Yes,"
said the consul. He took a ragged breath.
"But first the rest of the story."
Hoyt stared, reached weakly for the injector. Sweating himself now, the consul held the instrument just out of reach.
"Yes, in a second. After the rest of the story, it's important that I know."
Oh, God, sweet Jesus, please!
Yes. Yes, as soon as you tell me the truth.
Father Hoyt collapsed onto his forearms, breathing in quick pants.
You fucking bastard! He gasped.
The priest took several deep breaths, held one until his body quit shaking, and tried to sit up. When he looked at the consul, there was something like relief in the maddened eyes.
Then you'll give me the shot?
Yes.
All right. The truth. Paracebo Plantation, like I said. We flew in early October. Lysias, 8 years after Duray, disappeared. Oh, Christ, it hurts. Alcohol and endos don't work at all anymore, only pure ultramorph.
Yes. It's ready, as soon as the story is done.
The priest lowered his head. Sweat dripped from his cheeks and nose onto the short grass. The consul saw the man's muscles tense, as if he were going to attack. Then another spasm of pain racked the thin body, and Hoyt sagged forward.
Skimmer wasn't destroyed by Tesla. Sempha, two men and I, forced down near the cleft while Orlandi searched upriver. His skimmer had to wait while the lightning storm died down. Bikura came in the night. Killed Sempha. The pilot, the other man, forget his name, left me alive.
Hoyt reached for his crucifix, realized that he had torn it off. He laughed briefly, stopping before the laughter turned to sobs.
They told me about the way of the cross, about the cruciform, told me about the Son of the Flames. Next morning they took me to see the Son, took me to see him.
Hoyt struggled upright and clawed at his own cheeks. His eyes were wide, the ultramorph obviously forgotten despite the pain.
About 3 kilometers into the flame forest. Big Tesla. 80, 100 meters tall at least. Quiet then, but still a lot of charge in the air. Ash everywhere. The Bakura wouldn't go too close, just knelt there with their goddamn bald heads bowed. But I went close, had to. Dear God, oh Christ, it was him. Duray, what was left of him. He'd used a ladder to get 3, maybe 4 meters up on the bole of the tree, built a sort of platform for his feet. Broken the arrestor rods off, little more than spikes, then sharpened them. Must have used a rock to drive the long one through his feet into the Bestos platform and tree. His left arm, he'd pounded the stake between the radius and ulna. Missed veins, just like the goddamned Romans. Very secure as long as his skeleton was intact. Other hand, right hand, palm down, he'd driven the spike first. Sharpened both ends, then impaled his right hand. Somehow bent the spike over. Hook. Ladder'd fallen long ago. But it was Bestos. Hadn't burned. Used it to climb up to him. Everything'd burned away years ago. Clothes, skin, top layers of flesh. But the Bestos pouch was still around his neck. The alloy spikes still conducted current, even when I could see it, feel it, surging through what was left of the body. It still looked like Paul Duray. Important, I told Monsignor, no skin, flesh raw or boiled away, nerves and things visible like gray and yellow roots. Christ, the smell! But it still looked like Paul Duray. I understood then. Understood it all. Somehow. Even before reading the journals. Understood he'd been hanging there, oh dear God, 7 years, living, dying, the cruciform forcing him to live again. Electricity surging through him every second of those 7 years. flames, hunger, pain, death, but somehow the goddamned cruciform, leeching substance from the tree, maybe, the air, what was left. Rebuilding what it could, forcing it to live, to feel the pain over and over and over. But he won. Pain was his ally. Oh, Jesus, not a few hours on the tree and then the spear and rest, but 7 years. But he won. When I removed the pouch, the cruciform on his chest fell away also. Just fell right off. Long, bloody roots. Then the thing. The thing I'd been sure was a corpse. The man raised its head. No eyelids. Eyes baked white. Lips gone. But it looked at me and smiled. He smiled. And he died. Really died. There in my arms. The 10,000th time, but real this time. He smiled at me and died. Hoyt stopped, communed in silence with his own pain, and then continued between bouts of clenching his teeth. Bicorta took me back to Cleft. Orlandi came the next day, rescued me. He, Sempha, I couldn't. He lasered the village, burned the Bakura where they stood like stupid sheep. I didn't argue with him. I laughed. Dear God, forgive me. Orlandi nuked the site with shaped charges they used to clear the jungle, fiberplastic matrix. Hoyt looked directly at the consul and made a contorted gesture with his right hand. The painkillers worked all right at first, but every year, every day, got worse. Even in fugue, the pain. I would have had to come back anyway. How could he? 7 years. Oh, Jesus, said Father Hoyt, and clawed at the carpet. The consul moved quickly, injecting the full ampule of ultramorph just under the armpit, catching the priest as he collapsed, and gently lowering the unconscious form to the floor. His vision unclear, the consul ripped open Hoyt's sweat-sodden shirt, casting the rags aside. It was there, of course, lying under the pale skin of Hoyt's chest like some great, raw, cross-shaped worm. The consul took a breath and gently turned the priest over. The second cruciform was where he had expected to find it, a slightly smaller, cross-shaped welt between the thin man's shoulder blades. It stirred slightly as the consul's fingers brushed the fevered flesh. The consul moved slowly but efficiently, packing the priest's belongings, straightening the room, dressing the unconscious man with the gentle care one would use in clothing the body of a dead family member. The consul's comm log buzzed.
"We need to go,"
came Colonel Kassad's voice.
"We're coming,"
replied the consul. He coded the comm log to summon crew clones to fetch the luggage, but lifted Father Hoyt himself. The body seemed to weigh nothing. The pod door dilated open, and the consul stepped out, moving from the deep shadow of the branch into the blue-green glow of the world which filled the sky. Deciding what cover story he would tell the others, the consul paused a second to look at the sleeping man's face. He glanced up at Hyperion and then moved on. Even if the gravity field had been full Earth standard, the consul knew, the body in his arms would have been no burden. Once a parent to a child now dead, the consul walked on, knowing once again the sensation of bearing a sleeping son to bed. 2. It had been a warm, rainy day in Keats,
Hyperion's capital. And even after the rain stopped, a layer of clouds moved slow and heavy over the city, filling the air with the salt scent of the ocean 20 kilometers to the west. Toward evening, as the gray daylight was beginning to fade into gray twilight, a double sonic boom shook the town and then echoed from the single, sculpted peak to the south. The clouds glowed blue-white. Half a minute later, an ebony spacecraft broke through the overcast and descended carefully on a tail of fusion flame, its navigation lights blinking red and green against the gray. At 1,000 meters, the craft's landing beacons flared, and 3 beams of coherent light from the spaceport north of town locked the ship in a welcoming ruby tripod. The spacecraft hovered at 300 meters, slipped sideways as smoothly as a mug sliding on a wet tabletop, and then settled weightlessly into a waiting blast pit. High-pressure jets of water bathed the pit and the base of the ship, sending up billows of steam to blend with the curtains of drizzle blowing across the paved plain of the spaceport. When the water jets ceased, there was no noise except the whisper of rain and the random ticks and creaks of the cooling spaceship. A balcony extruded itself from the ship's bulkhead 20 meters above the pit wall. 5 figures emerged.
"Thank you for the ride, sir,"
Colonel Cassad said to the consul. The consul nodded and leaned on the railing, taking in deep breaths of fresh air. Droplets of rain beaded on his shoulders and eyebrows. Saul Weintraub lifted his baby from her infant carrier. Some change in pressure, temperature, scent, motion, noise, or a combination of all of these had awakened her, and now she began to cry lustily. Weintraub bounced her and cooed to her, but the wailing continued.
"An appropriate comment upon our arrival,"
said Martin Silenus. The poet wore a long purple cape and a red beret, which slouched to his right shoulder. He took a drink from a wine glass he had carried out from the lounge.
"Christ on a stick! This place looks different."
The consul, who had been away only 8 local years, had to agree. The spaceport had been a full 9 clicks from the city when he lived in Keats. Now shacks, tents, and mud streets surrounded the landing field's perimeter. In the consul's day, no more than a ship a week had put in at the tiny spaceport. Now he counted more than 20 spacecraft on the field. The small administration and customs building had been superseded by a huge, prefabricated structure. 12 new blast pits and dropship grids had been added where the field had been hastily extended to the west, and the perimeter now was littered with scores of camouflage-sheathed modules, which the consul knew must serve as everything from ground control stations to barracks. A forest of exotic antennae grew skyward from a cluster of such boxes at the far end of the landing apron.
"Progress,"
murmured the consul.
"War,"
said Colonel Cassad.
"Those are people,"
said Braun Lamia, pointing toward the main terminal gates on the south side of the field. A wave of drab colors crashed like a silent surf against the outer fence and the violet containment field.
"My God,"
said the consul.
"You're right."
Cassad produced his binoculars, and they took turns staring at the thousands of forms tugging at the wire, pressing against the repelling field.
"Why are they here? What do they want?"
Even from 0.5 kilometer away, the mindless will of the mob was daunting. Dark forms of force marines could be seen patrolling just within the perimeter. The consul realized that between the wire, the containment field, and the marines, a strip of raw earth almost surely signified mines, or a death beam zone, or both.
"What do they want?"
repeated Lamia.
"They want out,"
said Cassad. Even before the colonel spoke, the consul realized that the shack city around the spaceport and the mob at the gates were inevitable. The people of Hyperion were ready to leave. He guessed that there must be such a silent surge toward the gates each time a ship landed.
"Well, there's one who'll be staying,"
said Martin Silenus, and pointed toward the low mountain across the river to the south.
"Old weeping William Rex, God rest his sinful soul."
The sculpted face of sad King Billy was just visible through the light rain and growing darkness.
"I knew him, Horatio,"
said the drunken poet.
"A man of infinite jest. Not one of them funny. A real horse's ass, Horatio."
Saul Weintraub stood just inside the ship, shielding his baby from the drizzle and removing her cries from the vicinity of the conversation. He pointed.
"Someone is coming."
A ground car, with its camouflage polymer inert, and a military EMV modified with hover fans for Hyperion's weak magnetic field, were crossing the damp hardpan. Martin Silenus's gaze never left sad King Billy's dour visage. Silenus said in a voice almost too soft to be heard,
"Deep in the shady sadness of a vale, far sunken from the healthy breath of morn, far from the fiery noon and eve's one star, sat gray-haired Saturn, quiet as a stone, still as the silence round about his lair, forest on forest hung above his head, like cloud on cloud."
Father Hoyt came onto the balcony, rubbing his face with both hands. His eyes were wide and unfocused, a child rising from his nap. "Are we there?"
"Fucking aye,"
cried Martin Silenus, returning the binoculars to the colonel.
"Let's go down and greet the gendarmes."
The young Marine lieutenant seemed unimpressed with the group, even after he had scanned the authorization wafer Hetmastine had passed along from the task force commander. The lieutenant took his time scanning their visa chips, letting them wait in the drizzle, occasionally making a comment with the idle arrogance common to such nobodies who have just come into a small bit of power. Then he came to Fedman Kassad's chip and looked up with the expression of a startled stoat.
"Colonel Kassad!"
"Retired."
"I'm sorry, sir," said the lieutenant, stumbling over his words as he fumbled the visas back to everyone. "I had no idea you were with this party, sir. That is, the captain just said... I mean, my uncle was with you on Brescia, sir. I mean, I'm sorry. Anything I or my men can do to..."
"At ease, lieutenant. Is there any chance of getting some transport into the city?"
"Ah, well, sir..."
The young Marine started to rub his chin, and then remembered that he was wearing his helmet. "Yes, sir. But the problem is, sir, the mobs can get pretty nasty and... Well, the damn EMVs don't work for shit on this... pardon me, sir. You see, the ground transports are limited to cargo, and we don't have any skimmers free to leave the base until 2200 hours. But I'll be happy to get your party on the roster for..."
"Just a minute,"
said the consul. A battered passenger skimmer with the gold geodesic of the hegemony painted on one flare skirt had landed 10 meters away. A tall, thin man stepped out.
"Theo!"
cried the consul. The two men stepped forward, started to shake hands, and then hugged each other instead.
"Damn, you look good, Theo."
It was true. His former aide had gained half a dozen years on the consul, but the younger man still had the boyish smile, thin face, and thick red hair that had attracted every unmarried woman, and not a few married ones, on the consulate staff. The shyness which had been part of Theo Lane's vulnerability was still there, as evidenced by the way he now needlessly adjusted his archaic horn-rimmed glasses, the young diplomat's one affectation.
"It's good to have you back,"
said Theo. The consul turned and started to introduce his friend to the group and then stopped.
"My God, you're consul now. I'm sorry, Theo, I wasn't thinking."
Theo Lane smiled and adjusted his glasses.
"No problem, sir. Actually, I'm no longer consul. For the last few months, I've been acting Governor General. The Home Rule Council finally requested and received formal colonial status. Welcome to the newest world in the hegemony.
The consul stared a second, and then hugged his former protege again.
Congratulations, Your Excellency.
Theo grinned and glanced at the sky.
It's going to rain in earnest before long. Why don't we get your group aboard the skimmer and I'll drive you into town?
The new Governor General smiled at the young Marine.
Lieutenant?
Yes, sir? The officer had snapped to attention.
Could you get your men to load these good people's luggage, please? We'd all like to get in out of the rain.
The skimmer flew south above the highway at a steady 60 meters. The consul rode in the front passenger seat. The rest of the group relaxed in flow-foam recliners behind. Martin Silenus and Father Hoyt appeared to be asleep. Weintraub's baby had ceased crying in favor of nursing on a soft bottle of synthesized mother's milk.
Things have changed, said the consul.
He rested his cheek against the rain-spattered canopy and looked down at the chaos. Thousands of shacks and lean-tos covered the hillsides and gullies along the 3-click ride to the suburbs. Fires were being lighted under wet tarps, and the consul watched mud-colored figures moving between mud-colored shacks. High fences had been rigged along the old spaceport highway, and the road itself had been widened and regraded. 2 lanes of truck and hover traffic, most of it military green or shrouded with inactive camouflage polymer, moved sluggishly in both directions. Ahead, the lights of Keats seemed to have multiplied and spread across new sections of the river valley and hills.
3 million,
said Theo, as if reading his former boss's mind.
At least 3 million people, and growing every day.
The consul stared.
There were only 4.5 million people on the planet when I left. Still are,
said the new Governor General.
And every one of them wants to get to Keats, board a ship, and get the hell out. Some are waiting for the Farcaster to be built, but most don't believe it'll happen in time. They're afraid.
Of the Ousters?
Them, too. But mostly of the Shrike.
The consul turned his face from the coolness of the canopy.
It's come south of the Bridal Range, then.
Theo laughed without humor.
It's everywhere. Or they're everywhere. Most people are convinced that there are dozens or hundreds of the things now. Shrike deaths have been reported on all 3 continents, everywhere except Keats, segments of the coast along the main, and a few of the big cities like Endymion.
How many casualties?
The consul did not really want to know.
At least 20,000 dead or missing. There are a lot of injured people, but that isn't the Shrike, is it?
Again came the dry laugh.
The Shrike doesn't just wound people, does it? Uh-uh. People shoot each other by accident, fall down stairways, or jump out windows in their panic, and trample each other in crowds. It's a fucking mess.
In the 11 years the consul had worked with Theo Lane, he had never heard the younger man use profanity of any sort.
Is force any help? Are they what's keeping the Shrike away from the big cities?
Theo shook his head.
Force hasn't done a damn thing except control the mobs. Ah, the Marines put on a show of keeping the spaceport open here and the harbor landing zone at Port R secure. But they haven't even tried to confront the Shrike. They're waiting to fight the Ousters.
SDF?
Asked the consul, knowing even as he spoke that the poorly trained self-defense force would have been of little use. Theo snorted.
At least 8,000 of the casualties are SDF. General Braxton took the